Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to a new episode in the New Books and Gender Studies podcast, part of the New Books Network. I'm one of your co-hosts, Kyle McMillan, and today I have the pleasure of being joined by Assistant Professor Trent McNamara from Texas A&M University, talking about his new book, Birth Control and American Modernity, A History of Popular Ideas. Professor, how are you doing today?
Just great. Thanks for having me, Kyle.
Yeah, and I kind of wanted to start out by talking about sort of your academic background. How did you get interested in this topic, and ultimately, what drove you to write this book?
So I got to this topic kind of sideways. I went to graduate school at Columbia, and I went there initially to do environmental history. I was going to write about big infrastructure, especially in cities, and the environmental movement. But I eventually decided I wanted to write about sort of big ideas that were important to quote-unquote ordinary people. So sort of how people like you and me, so to speak, apply philosophical principles to finding a good life. And so I was still interested in environmental questions. And so I tried to find a topic where I could find people talking, especially about the moral authority of nature. I found that in Birth Control, but then eventually the book became a much broader topic. We can't really encompass the motivations for birth control with nature. So it became a much more sprawling topic. So I guess the short answer is, like many people, I went to grad school to do one thing and ended up doing something just utterly different.
Right. I think that process is pretty common, at least with some of my colleagues as well. So ultimately, this book is about, sort of you started to describe it there, is about the process in which birth control becomes sort of a popular idea or gains popularity among, you know, quote unquote, lay people. So what were the attitudes around birth control at the turn of the 20th century, sort of where you begin your book? And what did you use to find out?
So to take the second part first, the sources I used kind of fall between the sources or data that are used by kind of the two big approaches to this question about why people control births. So on the one hand, you have historical demographers who use large quantifiable data sources, social indicators and that kind of thing. And on the other hand, you have traditional narrative historians who tend to focus more on the records, the words and deeds of people who worked in the birth control sphere professionally as activists. What I tried to do is kind of bridge the gap between those two fields. There are two fields that have enormous literatures but don't really talk to each other that much. And so I tried to kind of bridge the gap between them by finding sources that were that existed in large volumes, like personal letters or field reports or replies to a radio show, for example, where there were hundreds of replicated sources written by ordinary people to someone who had a vested interest. So it's kind of these bulk qualitative sources. And what I found in those sources is it's a tremendously complex story. You know, we tend to think of birth control as being about these principled activists who stood up on the soapbox and said, you know, this is right, this is important, this is what women should have, this is what people should have. And that's a very important part of the story. But what you see in the kind of the citizen movement or the mass movement, which I argue is more indispensable to the ultimate success of the larger movement, is a much more ambivalent, qualified movement of people who don't really think of themselves as for birth control, but just have their own motives to use it, and to use it in increasingly over time. So, you know, we can talk about those motives in detail if you want, but it's a sort of tangle of ideas about nature and God and the intersection of moral principle with economics. So not so much about economic rationality, which a lot of the demographers are into, but about the rightful uses of money. So no one really doubts that having a smaller family is rational. There's not much debate about whether it's costly to have kids. No one really thinks like, oh, I'm a farmer, so I'm going to have kids because it's economically rational. Everyone agrees that kids are costly. It's about the correct ratio of income to kids. How much of your money should you plow into kids, and how much should you put into other avenues to a good life? So there's all these different ideas. One of the key points the book makes is that for ordinary people, again, that's just a distinction to elites, for ordinary people, a lot of those ideas get kind of bundled together into a convenient package, sort of nugget, that has to do with the idea of the times changing or of modern life. The people in these letters or in letters to the editor or whatever it was, they're constantly talking about how the times demand greater control over fertility. This is sort of juggernaut of history that pushes people inevitably towards this outcome. And they're not really helpless, but the way they judge that modern push towards smaller families, is that part of the good in modern life? Is it progress? Is it part of the bad? Is it decadence? That's a major factor in how they ultimately act in terms of the size of their family. So these changes, you know, people perceive secularization, they perceive greater economic rationality, they perceive less deference to nature or sort of fatalistic view of the universe. But all of those tend to be bundled together into this meta narrative about history changing, flux demanding certain things of people, which they would be, which they resist at their own risk.
Yeah. And one of the interesting sort of convergences between a few of these ideas, especially ones about nature and sort of ideas that sort of elites in society are putting out, is the role that, at least at the beginning of this century, that Teddy Roosevelt plays in this sort of meta narrative, right? So he sort of, you know, picks up the idea, but really popularizes this sort of race suicide idea. So what did that have to do with sort of the broader notions about modernity and birth control?
Yeah, so Roosevelt, despite not being an ordinary person in the terms that I'm using, is very much, he articulates this idea. He says, you know, I think the quote is, the tendencies of our time inevitably discourage large families. It's just about whether we should resist that tendency or not. And, you know, for him, the answer was obviously, yes, we need to resist it. So he was Roosevelt was a kind of an acute student of demographic trends. Around the time he begins to look at the presidency, vital statistics are getting better. Demographers are beginning to put together a long-range trend line in U.S. fertility that points from, you know, around seven children per woman in 1800 to about 3.5 in 1900. And, you know, for Roosevelt and his allies, that does not look like a trend line towards a kind of benign equilibrium at, you know, say 1.5 or 2 or 2.5 children. That's a trend line towards zero. Roosevelt popularizes the term race suicide for that trend line towards zero. He invests it with significance, not just we hear the term race suicide. You think about racism and sort of white nationalist idea, which has been revived today. Roosevelt means something a little bit different. As you know, the ideas of race back then were more fluid and could mean more things. What he essentially means is the suicide of people who are not recent immigrants, not Black, and not white, native, and very poor. So kind of the enfranchised, civically engaged majority, which he sees as essential to the American experiment. If these people don't reproduce themselves, we can't assimilate new immigrants, we can't kind of continue this world-changing experiment in democracy. So when he pipes up, you know, this is a president. People are used to the president talking about, you know, tariffs and how many ships we have in the Navy and stuff. All of a sudden, he's talking about people's intimate behavior in the bedroom, essentially. This is a major moment, and it sparks this major debate that allowed me, in turn, to kind of look at ordinary people's ideas about birth control.
Yeah, and you know, as you progress in the book to the 1920s and 1930s, sort of this post-Roosevelt time, you say that birth control had sort of gained this sort of muted legitimacy. So how did it sort of get to that point, and why was it still sort of muted at this point?
We're talking about these very slow moving and again, ambivalent processes. I say in the book that a lot of this is a debate between, moderates over the definition of moderation. There's almost nobody in this debate, at the kind of local community level, who thinks that birth control is always good and should be maximized, or that it's always bad and should be banned like alcohol was in this period. So instead, it's just kind of this debate over these shades of gray. You know, my husband's a clerk and, you know, we're not really struggling, but we have a kind of small apartment. You know, do we put two kids in the same room? Can we reasonably educate them? How much should we let them kind of just try their own hand in life? How much should we try to give them a leg up socially to advance, which is sort of the, you know, the ultimate American dream, to have your kids do better than you do. So there's just this core ambiguity, and yet you have a gradual shift as birth control becomes more popular at the local level, as it's something that I can sit in my kitchen and tell my husband I support, or tell my wife I support, as that becomes something I can talk to my, you know, my family and my friends about, or even talk about at a church picnic or whatever, it's becoming more legitimate. to the point where eventually the anti-birth control laws have never been especially effective, are formally repealed, and you have a kind of making real of what had already become a folk reality that birth control was both popular and informally legitimate.
Yeah, and part of, I think, goes into these shades of gray that people were negotiating sort of slowly over time is sort of what was actually meant by birth control, right? Because we don't yet have, you know, at this point in the book, we do not have sort of what has become shorthand for birth control, which is the pill, right? So what exactly were people, you know, what was in that broad definition of what people were considering birth control in all of these gray areas?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I mean, that's one of the things I struggle with in this book. It's a definitional issue, because when we hear the term birth control now, we kind of read backwards through the 1960s and think of it as a technology, and it's particularly it's the pill, and it's a technology sort of for and by women. And that definition has a lot to do with Margaret Sanger, who we can talk about or not later, but it does not fit especially well onto the phenomenon of just controlling births. There's birth control, there's the technology, and there's the phenomenon. And I think it's hard to get at how birth control becomes legitimate unless you're talking about the phenomenon. The technology is sort of downstream of a larger phenomenon. So when you're talking about how people control births before we have birth control in the modern colloquial sense, people have lots of methods. The most common methods of birth control before the pill are condoms and douches, often with spermicides, and then the kind of perennial immortal technique of coitus interruptus, or withdrawal, which of course is going, it goes back so far that it's discussed in the Bible. God smites Onan for that sin. There's a court case from 1771 in Massachusetts where a man facing a paternity suit says to the court, quote, "I fucked her once, but I minded my pullbacks." So this is it's sort of this ancient technique, which is in wide circulation in the 1910s or 20s or 30s and well before. And then there are other techniques like the use of abortifacients and kind of magical methods, which are sort of on the on a border between what we might consider birth control and the wider control of births. If you want to discuss those, we can, but we can move on to.
Yeah, well, part of my next question kind of brings up the role that folks like Sanger had in sort of this larger conversation, but you know, sticking within this, you know, period of the early decades of the 20th century, one of the interesting gray areas, or I guess what some people might consider, you know, contradictory parts of this movement toward popularity for birth control is the role that the eugenics movement, but also early feminist activists had to shape this debate. So how did these two camps sort of shape the debate and work together either in conjunction or in sort of contradiction to one another?
There's been a lot of writing about the alliances between feminist activists and the birth control movement, most notably Sanger, who kind of steals the show, mostly for good reason. She was very prominent. Their alliances with the eugenics movement. I'd say they were both very important. The reason Sanger courted eugenicists was not out of any independent conviction that they were right. She was very sympathetic to the poor and saw her movement as serving the poor and saw them as unfairly maligned by elitist eugenicists. She also tactically saw those people as important to recruiting conservative opinion to her side. Speaking about it in a purely tactical sense, I think they probably performed some of that task for her. They made it possible for, you know, say you run a salon in Cincinnati and you have tea every week and you're the wife of a conservative politician. You could say, well, birth control is acceptable because it's going to cut down on the numbers of the poor that we have here in our slums, and that's going to benefit not just us, the elite who are worried about those poor people. It's also going to benefit the poor themselves. So if you take it beyond the level of elite activists, even then it's able to change the conversation a bit at the local community level. I think dedicated activists like Sanger perform a similar function. You know, part of the book's point is that it's maybe not entirely historically accurate to put Sanger in the center of the birth control story. You know, if you read a U.S. history textbook, Sanger very often more or less is the birth control story. And she's not that indispensable to the wider movement, to the reasons that the birth control movement is a success. But she is tremendously important both to thousands of individual poor women who had not, for various reasons, been able to acquire effective contraception. And she's also important in this kind of conversation-moving aspect that you asked me about. She does kind of help to set the margins of debate so that someone who supports birth control in a moderate way can say, you know, well, I'm no Margaret Sanger. She's a radical, but I do think that such and such and such and such is a good argument for birth control. So she kind of redefines where the center is by at least initially taking a radical stand. So I think she's important to the movement. You know, if I had written this book in a historiographical void, and I just wanted to write anything about birth control, I think I might very well have written a book that was much more about her story, just because it's interesting, and I enjoy the ability to write about an individual person and their moral struggle for a cause I support. But as it was, that story has been told many times, and I thought the kind of wider context for the movement's success was historiographically more needed and important.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and part of the reason that, you know, you bring up that argument that Sanger might not be the end-all be-all in this story is that you say that, you know, in the early decades of the 20th century, birth control isn't necessarily seen as a women's issue, right? That's some, that's another thing that we sort of read backwards in history, right? When we think about debates around birth control. So why was it the case that this hadn't been yet defined as sort of a women's issue, quote unquote?
Well, so there are some practical reasons for that. So Sanger emerges in the 1910s. And for her, it's always from the start and to the end, it's a women's issue. So other less prominent activists, they encourage her to give up on what they call sex exclusion or antagonism. And she declines. She says, no, this is a women's issue and it's a women's issue alone. And that's kind of been written into the historiography ever since, in particular because Sanger has a big role in developing the pill. So that kind of Sanger pill story is the big story right now. But up until her period, there are these practical reasons why birth control is not particularly considered a women's movement. It's not a men's movement either, but it's considered this kind of movement around these big macro historical ideas, these big moral choices people face in modernity. Because, for example, although women often were more morally supportive of birth control as a right that women should have, in, say, 1895, often men make consequential household decisions. They're the ones who ultimately have a say over whether, you know, we have three kids or four. Also, men are responsible for their family's economic well-being. They are held to account if they don't support their children up to the standards of their communities. Birth control also relied heavily on male methods, like coitus interruptus or condoms. And then maybe most important is that social norms in that period made it very difficult for women to talk about contraception, including with their husbands. So there's a much higher potential social cost for you as a woman to go out to your pharmacist, for example, and ask about buying a contraceptive or to ask your mother or your friends. Because you risked seeming sexually overactive, prurient, calculating, unwomanly. Whereas a man informally could go out and do that. And he just seems like he's kind of street smart, virile. Like he knows, he's savvy in the ways of the world. So for all those reasons, you don't really see. It's very surprising in a way. Like when I went into this research, I fully expected to see this framed entirely as a woman's topic in popular sources, but it's really not. And it's framed as this issue that concerns both sexes about these big moral historical changes from generation to generation. It's about God and nature and time, but not really about men or women in particular. So I actually went through and tabulated all this stuff. Like I have tables upon tables of what these documents say. And it's more common for people to frame it as a women's issue than a men's issue. But for many people, it is a men's issue. And then in both of those cases are just vastly less common and to frame it as this larger kind of civilizational issue.
Yeah, and I think that's just such an interesting point. So one of the interesting source, like set of source materials that you found or utilized was sort of this journal, the Birth Control Review. So what was that and how did it shape the public consciousness around birth control?
So Birth Control Review was Sanger's publication. She was the editor and kind of the spirit behind it. It was an advocacy publication. If you were a member of the American Birth Control League, her organization, you got a subscription. One of the main things that the birth control review did is print letters that Sanger received from ordinary people who wanted contraception, who wanted advice from her. She received many thousands of these letters. It's hard to say exactly how many, but it's probably in the low to middle hundreds of thousands of letters over her career, with a huge peak in the early 20s when she published two books that implied that writing to her might get you better advice on contraceptives. The letters... So the review never had a huge circulation, so it's not going to have the same public impact as just an ordinary newspaper article on this topic. But the letters are important in the sense that they give a window on how ordinary people justify contraception to themselves, how they saw it. There's a lot of material on poverty, on economic struggles, even outside of poverty, and then on health, especially women's health issues around pregnancy, both physical health at a time when pregnancy was very dangerous, and their mental health. The trouble with these letters is that Sanger destroyed virtually all of them. So hundreds of thousands of letters are just gone. The justification being, we think that she saw them as medical records that had to be destroyed. However, the letters that survived are not representative. She said that they were, that they represented the letters of everyone, but the ones that have survived and ones that were written to affiliate organizations and to other birth control activists are not like the ones she published. The ones she published are the most poignant, understandably. They come from married women who are very poor and are in dire straits. But most of the letters she received were probably much shorter, contained little or no justification, because people already saw birth control as being locally legitimate. And then, you know, you get letters like, you know, dear Dr. Sanger, is this brand of condoms the latest in terms of birth control? Signed, you know, Hilda Bennett from Tennessee. It's just like one line that's basically treating Sanger as if she were some kind of sort of higher level national pharmacist who had access to incrementally better contraception, as opposed to the way Sanger sort of saw herself, which was as leading this sort of future facing movement that was going to change everything for women in particular, especially poor women, forever.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that you sort of end that chapter on, or, you know, sort of around that point in the book, is you start to sort of anticipate, or at least what I saw as an anticipation of somebody reading the book and being like, wait, wasn't there a baby boom there in the middle of the century? So what is the baby boom sort of, how does that intercept with these notions around birth control and the gaining popularity of them?
So the baby boom is really one of history's mysteries. Like, nobody really knows why the baby boom happened. I was at a conference recently where somebody was just asking this question, and I'm not sure I've ever been to a conference where the answer is just genuinely, we're not sure. But that was more or less the answer. You know, I speculate a bit. That's not the topic of my book. I'm interested in this topic. You know, if you have this like big macro historical sense that history wants you to have fewer kids, that reaches back into the 19th century and through the early 20th, you know, why does it suddenly reverse in the 40s and 50s into the early 60s, before then mysteriously cratering again to a much lower birth rate? I think part of the answer to that is that we tend to assume the baby boom is about people sort of walking out and suddenly wanting to have much larger families. It's not so much about that as it's about more people total having families, having children at any number. So it's more about more people having what was by then considered the normal 2 or 3 child family. And that bringing the overall averages up. So there's a little bit less of a phenomenon to explain in that sense. And then I also think that, you know, what we're talking about here with these macro historical issues, it's not based on a historical understanding like you or I might have of history. It's based on these narratives, which are largely imaginary, almost like the narratives that we write for ourselves about our own lives. Except social and historical. And because they're kind of imaginary, they can sort of flip on on a dime. And so it's plausible to me that someone like Elaine Tyler May, a historian, writes about the security culture after World War II. It's plausible to me that people started to tell themselves a different story after World War II, one that was more about sort of contributing babies, I guess, bodies, biological stock to this victorious nation that had to come together against communism. But the short answer, in deference to those people I saw at the conference, is that we don't really know. So yeah, that's another book, another person.
Right. And the final two chapters before you get to your conclusion, you really outline two ways that the talk around birth control, the sort of wider acceptance of it as a topic, just in general, becomes a lot more mobile. So how did that... you have one chapter that's called missionary work, right? So what was happening that people were sort of going out into the world and preaching, sort of the quote unquote good word about birth control?
So I read about two people who did that, one of whom was an obstetrician named James Cooper, who Sanger hired essentially as her emissary to the provinces. She was in New York. She had a reputation for radicalism that prevented her from reaching more conservative audiences, and especially doctors. And so she convinced her husband, Noah Slee, who was also her major financial benefactor in the 20s, to finance this obstetrician's tour around the U.S. And he went to hundreds of cities and spoke to both medical and lay audiences. And then he wrote reports after these talks, which is what I use. So I'm not really interested in him so much as in his audiences and their kind of halting acceptance, their discussions about whether a respectable doctor or salon host in Detroit in 1927 could sponsor a talk by a pro-birth control speaker and retain their good standing in the community. So that's very interesting. I think that speakers like Cooper, who went out and beat the bushes, did make a difference. But as Cooper himself reported, a lot of that difference had already been made at the local level, often without knowledge of the formal movement for which he spoke, and often with suspicion of that formal movement as a kind of half-known radical New York City concern. And the other one you mentioned is Ben Lindsay, who was a famous for his work with the juvenile justice, and who, in 1927, when the radio was a newfangled invention, went on the airwaves speaking basically to the middle third of the country, the Great Plains, and said, birth control is great. We need it for various reasons. It's going to help us. It's going to liberate us. It's the libertarian option in a country that that values freedom. And it's the progressive option. It represents progress, not decadence. And to his radio show, you have hundreds of people write in. The station asked for their feedback in part to distance themselves from the controversy around the topic. So you have people write in from, you know, rural North Dakota, these small towns and farms on the Great Plains, places where you wouldn't necessarily expect there to be a lot of pro-birth control sentiment, especially for this, which was the first radio address to support birth control in this country. But it's mostly positive. It's about two-thirds positive feedback, and then some neutral, and there still is considerable opposition to birth control. It's a kind of interesting window on what these middle-class, radio-owning Plains people thought about this topic, the first time that many of them hear it publicly discussed, at least on the radio.
Right. And, you know, now that we sort of, once you end that chapter, we then sort of bump up against sort of the era that we sort of colloquially think about when we think about sort of debates around birth control. And then you start talking about, how the ways that birth control is debated today and sort of going forward in sort of this global age we find ourselves in is going to be, you know, a continuation of this. But so could you sort of describe what you think about sort of this going forward look at birth control?
Yeah, so I talk about how, birth control is strongly associated with modernity and modernization in the period I'm talking about by just regular people, not modernization theorists, not academics. And that association is still very strong today. I think people associate birth control with modernity and vice versa. Modernity is birth control. So essentially, the more progress a place has undergone, the more advanced the place is, the more developed, the smaller the families. And then conversely, the smaller the families you have in the place, the more developed the place will be. It's just, it's like so inscribed in our culture that it's just an automatic, taken for granted idea. Development is towards this ideal where you have, among other things, a limited family, which in turn brings the economic benefits, brings the or reflects the social liberalism of our society and the things that we hold dear. And with the point I'm making at the end, when I bring things into the present in the epilogue, is just that although modernity and birth control have long been viewed as mutually complementary, they buttress each other, that as birth control spreads, and in particular as the most developed or advanced countries sustain decade over decade of very low fertility, so way below replacement level, that association could become mutually harmful. That's not to be taken for granted by any means. You know, demographic trends are very unpredictable. Nobody knew the baby boom was coming. No, absolutely, like zero people predicted that. This could all change, but it also could be dangerous for modern liberalism and for reproductive freedom, reproductive rights, in the sense that if countries like take South Korea, this kind of miracle of modernization that is kind of the story many other countries want to emulate in many ways. Now, South Korea's total fertility rate just fell below one child per woman. So that's that's a fertility rate that will see its baseline population fall by around half every generation. So that's not necessarily a catastrophe for Korea. There's ways to manage that. But what it does do, I think, is make it easier for a lot of demographically fearful populace, which we're seeing today, to paint liberal, modern, free societies as being unsustainable over time. So to paint it as kind of a trade-off between, yes, you have personal freedom, you have wealth, but ultimately your family, your extended clan, your religion, whatever you hold dear, is going to die off. It's a sort of a comfortable death cult. And that is a very dangerous argument. I think that's a sort of core threat to liberal democracies that we have to address. And it's harder to address if we take a narrow view of birth control and what it is and what it means. It's more about laws and technologies. It's easier to address if we think about birth control as this wider phenomenon in popular ideas that's very often about modernity itself.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting and poignant way to sort of end your book. And I know that we've taken up a lot of your time today, so I just have a sort of a couple remaining questions. So we covered a lot of topics, in your book. And I'm just wondering, if you had somebody read your book and you want them to have sort of one big takeaway, what do you think that would be?
That birth control is a bigger and older phenomenon than we typically think. It is fragile, as I just said. I think that's a key component to take away from the book. But it's also heartening if you support reproductive rights, that the movement is ultimately built on a widespread social foundation. It's, I think, more resilient than either its friends or its enemies tend to assume. But again, I resisted making that the conclusion of the book. I didn't, as you saw, the conclusion ends with that point, and then the epilogue is about why, we're still in a very precarious situation. It's not just about limited interventions in the law. It's also about these popular ideas which are spreading everywhere. It's no longer like low fertility is no longer just a kind of local, parochial, chauvinist concern of a few Western elites. About half the world's people now live in countries with below replacement fertility. So it's going to become a more and more global phenomenon. We have to think of big ideas to keep the movement healthy.
Yeah. And, just for my final question, if people, are really interested in the topics you bring up in this book, and they want to either learn more about this topic or sort of adjacent topics, what are sort of three book recommendations you can give our audience today?
The first one that comes to mind is a book similar to mine in some ways, but about a much earlier period. It's by Susan Klepp. It's called Revolutionary Conceptions. And it's about the earliest Americans to decide to have smaller families. Susan Klepp is she's avowedly a bit constrained by the number of sources that are available circa 1800. But it's very interesting. You know, she works from letters and from popular ideas too. It's a wonderful, well-written book. And then if I was going to move forward a little bit in time, there's a book called Devices and Desires by Andrea Tone, which is about sort of how birth control happened, the devices and the desires that people had to control fertility. And then lastly, there's the kind of the central book in birth control history. This is to some extent the book that I'm reacting to and trying to both correct and complement. And that is Linda Gordon's book, the most recent version of which is called The Moral Property of Women. And this book is more geared to the activist story, to Sanger and to people like her and to her activist opponents. But it's just a wonderful story. It is able to get into individual biography. And while I don't think that the activist story is really central to the larger birth control story, I do think it's important, among other reasons, because when you talk about Sanger, you do have an individual example of a person taking moral action, you know, saying, this is something I think is right, and I'm going to pursue it. And that's not the story of the popular movement. Again, that's usually much more ambivalent. But it does underscore the idea that it's about individuals and what they think is right. It's not just about big social indicators and averages.
Well, those all sound like excellent book recommendations. But first, before they check out that, I encourage everyone listening today to check out Dr. McNamara's book, Birth Control and American Modernity. Dr. McNamara, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Kyle. I really appreciate it.